The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Hi, welcome to Cover to Cover. I'm Mark DeWitt. Today we have the national bestseller and winner of the National Book Award with her brand new book in soft cover. It's The Ninth Hour, Alice McDermott. Alice, welcome.
Thank you so much.
All right, The Ninth Hour, you know, I was thinking today that you never know about a traffic accident. You always hear about traffic accidents, and maybe one person was killed. Was that actually suicide or maybe not? And I never thought of it this way. Mm-hmm. But in The Ninth Hour, right in the beginning, we have an apartment fire. And was it maybe just something wrong with the electric, or was there something more in The Ninth Hour? So tell me a little bit about the story of this book without giving anything away.
Too much away. Yeah. That's always the challenge, isn't it? Well, this book had sort of an unusual genesis for me. You know, this is my eighth novel. Everyone has come to life in a different way. This arose out of an interest I had simply because a friend over dinner mentioned that he had a recollection in his childhood of a very old man who lived with an aunt of his who had served as a substitute in the Civil War for one of his great uncles. Just, you know, chit-chat. But it really stayed with me, and I was just sort of fascinated by the whole idea of substitution, which went on during the Civil War, and you could say in some ways it still goes on today. That is, families could pay someone to take the place of a husband, a father, a son in the army. And I don't think of myself as a historical novel writer, but something about the idea stayed with me, and I started reading about it and thinking about it, and I think what appealed to me was the metaphorical implications of I'll put my life at risk so that you can stay safe. So a kind of selflessness. And, you know, you don't have to think too much about selflessness in the 21st century when you start to wonder, is that actually anything we value anymore? Do we even believe in it? Are we always suspicious of someone who seems to be giving up their lives? Yeah, what's their real motive? So thinking about those things and playing around with ideas and reading about substitutes, doing research, I was drawn to newspapers from the early part of the 20th century, mostly because, you know, you Google search, and I was searching substitute, and I was stumbling across a lot of obituaries in the early part of the 20th century for men who had served as substitutes and lived in the Civil War. And as I was doing that, my eye kind of went to a lot of articles, because these were big city newspapers, about mostly men committing suicide by turning on the gas in their tenements. It seemed almost every issue of old newspapers that I looked at in New York, Philadelphia, Washington area, Boston area, there'd just be a little notice of suicide. So I thought, am I writing a book about selflessness, or am I writing a book about someone who says, I don't care, my life is my own to take, metaphorically. So I thought I'd sort of take Emily Dickinson's advice to heart, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. So in order to write a book about sort of a contemplation in many ways about the value of selflessness, who is actually selfless, do we understand it, do we believe in it, I would start with an act that, from this particular character's point of view, seems entirely self-involved, and that is, I'm tired of living, I don't care what anybody else needs me to do. My time is my own, so much so that I'm going to take my own life. He closes up his tenement, turns on the gas. He has sent his newly pregnant wife out to go shopping. She comes back. She can't get into the apartment. She gets some of her neighbors to help. And one very helpful neighbor lights a match. there's an explosion, there's a fire. That's how the novel opens.
and that was really something that you just want to keep going with this. It's like, all right, now, is she going to realize that it was suicide? In the book, in the opening of the book, it almost looks like, oh, well, you know, there was a gas leak and the poor guy died. And so the novel begins.
Right.
What I thought was interesting also, you had a nun come in. And at the time, and I don't know, this probably took place, what, in the maybe 30s or so?
Yeah, early part of the 20th, right, right. Okay.
And nuns at one time were beggars for the church, would you say?
Yes, actually, even in my own experience growing up in the New York area, I recall nuns sitting in subway entrances, in lobbies of stores, department stores. There was, there were a tremendous number. You're talking, you know, when Brooklyn was Catholic, with a very big C, the city of churches, even into the 50s and the 60s and into the 70s, there were nuns everywhere, all on the streets. And yeah, so I realized with this story that, okay, this guy is gone, but he has left his obligations behind. He's a newly arrived immigrant, so is his wife. Where is the social safety net for a young woman alone in the city in a tenement? Her only means of support, her husband has died. She's expecting a child. And again, from my own experience, I knew this, and then I started to do some research. Well, of course, the social safety net would be the nursing sisters in the neighborhood. I did not want to write a book about nuns. It was everything in me said, oh my gosh, do not write a book about nuns. Stay away. But the logic of the story and the requirements of the story as I had set it going was that somebody has to come in and help out this poor widow, and it would have been these people, logically, authentically, historically, and it turned out metaphorically, because that's when I realized, oh, here are the selfless people I've been looking for to try to understand.
Yeah, she had asked early on, well, what are you going to do? Where are you going to go? Family, there's no family. She had nobody.
Right.
But she had a place to stay for the night.
Right, right.
So, that was where, you know, the nun came in at that point, I guess.
Yes, well, she came in and took charge. And a lot of the, you know, in the Catholic Church at that time, suicides were not allowed to be buried in consecrated ground. It was considered a grave mortal sin. Things have changed. The church can change, you know, rules can change. And since we understand suicide so much better now than we did then, that's no longer the case. But this, elderly nun who comes in and takes over, she doesn't agree with that rule at all. And so she tries to do her own little machinations to say, well, as you say, cast doubt on the fact of the suicide so that he can get a Catholic burial.
How much research did you have to do about Catholicism and nuns and what the rules were?
Quite a bit, and it was really great fun. After I was reconciled to the fact that I had this character who was a nun, and as nuns do, she also invited a couple more nuns into the story so that I could not shake them off in the first 50 pages. And then I realized, well, I'm not writing historical fiction, so I needed an order of nuns, yes, based on many of the nursing orders that operated in the United States and especially in New York at that time. But there wasn't one particular actual order that would sort of fit the requirements of the story as I saw them. So I thought, well, I have to start my own order. I'm going to found an order of nuns. So the research I did was just really to find out, how does one go about doing that? And reading about all the nuns who began their own orders, from the 1800s into the 1900s, I was astonished. I mean, I'm born and raised Catholic and 12 years of Catholic school before I got away and got to college. I didn't know the stories of these women, and I don't think we do. You know, I think nuns really have, the work they do has been so denigrated by popular culture. They're clowns, or they're mean, they're witches, they're monolithic, they're all this. Because they dress the same, we assume they're all the same. And I started reading the histories of what these women did, founding hospitals and schools and going and serving the poorest of the poor. All in the United States, it's amazing, but all over the world, women who didn't necessarily have great educations, but educated themselves so that they could educate others. It's just an amazing story. It really is a story that's been much, much denigrated and forgotten, even by the church, or especially by the patriarchy of the Catholic Church. So that was really eye-opening to me. And I don't think it takes a lot of wisdom or insight. It just takes a moment to pause and think about, well, who were these individual women who did this? And immediately you realize, well, they all had to be different. They were ambitious. They must have had very complex interior lives. I mean, to think about what they were doing, they were leaving their many of the orders. You left your family and you did not see your family again. And you lived in community. And again, you were out. The nursing nuns, especially, they were in the homes of the poor. They were there on the streets, in the homes, working mostly with the women and children, taking care of all kinds of things, that anything that needed to be taken care of, with, again, very little credit. From the church or from history looking back. So I founded my own order called the Little Nursing Sisters of the Sick Poor Congregation of Mary Before the Cross. I got as much grief and much grief and ambition as I could put into one title. And then sort of used everything that I learned about the actual orders and the various nuns who founded them to sort of portray each of the nuns, my fictional nuns, in a way that gave full respect to their individuality, to what brought them, to what they do, to how they felt about it. Were they always happy? Are they angelic? Of course not. They're human beings. They're human beings with tremendous ambition. I mean, to end suffering, you know, to take care of the poor, and also tremendous humility to do it without any thought of recompense or credit. So that was sort of the challenge, to make sure that each nun that I introduced had her own history and her own personality.
Looking at the history, and maybe there's not an answer for this, but what would be maybe the common thread that these women would go into that service?
Yeah, I don't know that there's one. I think maybe by conjecture. I mean, there were women who were forced into it by their families, not so much physically forced, but, you know, from the moment they were born, this is what you're going to do. For a good part, and again, this is based on research, and I hope it's reflected in the fictional characters, they were women who did have great ambition, who wanted to do something in the world. I mean, at this time, their options were to be married, and if they were Catholics, to have child after child and hope they lived long enough to see them grown, or you're an old maid. You know, and you could teach, or maybe in the cities you could have some kind of secretarial position. Here were women who wanted to do more than that, you know, in a society that did not give them many options. So they were willing to say, I'll give up the pleasures of married life. I'll give up the pleasures of family. I'll give up the personal. But I think there's involved in that has to be a great sense of self. It's ambition. So I think there's some selfishness in, even in the selflessness. You know, the other side of selflessness is always, well, while you're busy taking care of the poor, you're not visiting your old mother who would love to see you, you know. She might not think you're so great, you know. So just that complex human, you know, it's human. It's the connections of family, the connections to the world. And for these women, the connections to a extremely patriarchal hierarchy that nuns today are still dealing with. You know, again, no acknowledgement. I had a nun. I've been hearing from a lot of religious women since this book came out, which has been great fun. They're still here and they're still working. One group of nuns I was chatting with, they just started laughing and they said, you know, we got away with so much, you know, doing what we wanted to do, whether the church was helping us or not, because the priest didn't see any threat to their power by what we were doing because we were serving women and children and there was no power there. So they weren't jealous. So all you had to say was, I'm taking care of this widow. And they'd be like, go ahead, do whatever you want. There was no oversight. But if there was any power involved in it, the priest wanted a piece of that. So I think that makes, it made me very curious about who are these women? How interesting their inner lives must be, because they also must have a spiritual life that's in some way complex or even extremely simple. And then that, how do you reconcile a simple faith? I just believe everything that the church, that Christianity says, but I also want to be out on the street and see suffering every day. Who are these people?
No, I didn't go to Catholic church myself or Catholic school myself or church, but I do know some people that do. The way they talk, the nuns were kind of strict, almost kind of mean with the ruler across the knuckles. At the time you went, maybe you experienced some of that. You didn't realize the backstory, I guess, at the time you were in school about these people.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, a lot of the cliches and the stereotypes that many of us have about religious women is filtered through a child's eyes. Yes, I had mean nuns and I had wonderful nuns growing up, but you were afraid of them. And again, when you think about what the church asked them to do, even in the 50s and the 60s, when church schools were flourishing, you have one woman, again, don't know how educated she might have been, don't know what her background is, placed at the front of a classroom with 60 or 70 third graders. Can you imagine? You know, from 8:30 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon, no breaks, no, again, no credit, no teacher's aides. Of course they had to put the fear of God into those. Still, how would you keep them in their seats? And then when it was over, you go back and you have a little cell. Again, you only see looking back when I look at my own experience. Here were these poor women trying to teach us, again, no credit, no help. And some 20-something parish priest would come in, breeze into the classroom to either like give out report cards or to tell a joke. And here are these nuns, many of them in their 50s and 60s who had been in the service of the church would have to bow to them. Father's here. And, you know, and father would get all the love and the credit from the, and the kids were scared and hated sister so-and-so. I mean, can you imagine? No. So, yeah, I mean, the thing is, in order, I think, to defeat the stereotype of what religious women are, you have to admit some of them were awful, too. They are complex human beings. They got angry. They got frustrated. Maybe some of them got to their 50s and 60s and looked back and said, this wasn't worth it. Of course, they were human. And I think that's the acknowledgement that I was trying to at least illustrate in the novel, that these are complex people, just as any of us are. I've always believed it's the fiction writer's obligation to shake up the stereotype, to say, okay, maybe that's true in general, but this is a particular person who we've never seen before, just as any person is, who has a history, who is unique in every single way. And I think the fiction writer's obligation is to make every character as fully human as possible.
Let's talk about some of the other books that you've written, maybe going back to the very first and maybe the challenges that you saw in that book that you're not really seeing as you progress in writing.
Oh, that's an interesting question. In some ways, you know, every time you start a new book, whether it's your first, the first one you've tried to write or the seventh or eighth or ninth, you know, it's a new book. So you're a novice in many ways. This isn't the kind of profession where I think you really accrue benefit. It's a new story. You have new characters. You have to come up with new sentences. You have to figure out a new structure for the plot. You're starting all over again. I think my first novel, I had a kind of, you know, beginner's desperation, you know, that this might not go anywhere. No one may ever read it, but I must do it. I have to do it. I have to try it. This is the thing that I feel like I need to do. And I suppose by the eighth, you assume that what you're working on will eventually be read by someone. So it's not quite as desperate as those beginning. And in some ways, and this is when I teach, it fills me with admiration for my students. In some ways, there's something wonderful about a young writer who says, I have no idea if anyone is going to read this or it will be published, and yet I must do it, and I am doing it. I'm going to go ahead and do it. And I see with my students, who I know are so bright and so talented and could be doing any number of things. They are as smart as anyone on Wall Street or in a surgeon, or and they choose to tell stories, knowing how risky it is, but they must. And that's sort of delightful.
So where do you teach, and do you enjoy reading first-time authors?
Yeah, I teach at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and I do. I especially enjoy reading first-time authors who I'm working with, because then you can see them rising to the challenge. I think one of the most rewarding things about working with young writers is when you see things in their stories or their manuscripts that they haven't identified themselves, but they put there. I'm a great believer in the way I don't know if it's the unconscious or the subconscious finds its way into storytelling when someone's working at it, when someone's working at words. When you read a new manuscript and you see motifs, or you see repetitions, or you see connections that the writer put there, the writer just wasn't quite sure why or didn't quite know that she or he had. And when you can point that out and say, look, this all connects. Didn't you know that? And then they want to say, oh, yeah, of course I knew that. But I didn't know that until I did the writing. And that's very rewarding.
Yeah, that's probably one of the toughest parts of being an author, of writing, is putting those parts together, getting those separate stories that you intertwine in your novel.
Exactly, yeah. You know, and you're always asked as a writer, do you outline your whole story before you begin it? You know, do you just see what happens? This may be another thing that's a little bit different from when I first started out. I think when I first started out, I did do those outlines, just sort of clutching in hope I have some idea of what I'm talking about. Having done this long enough and having seen a lot of people, taken a lot of young writers through their first novels, I do see there's a great value in just getting it down and then reworking, do the revision that makes the plot logical, that makes all the connections clear to the reader, but leaving room for what you don't know about the story, sort of letting yourself be your own first reader and be surprised. All the things that come into a book, not when, you know, you're staring into a glass of wine, you know, or walking along romantically along the banks of the Seine, thinking about your novel. The things that come into any piece of writing when you're actually working at the words, when you're writing the sentence and you're listening to the rhythm of it and you're trying to find the vivid detail, that's when all the things you don't know about your story at first begin to reveal themselves.
You know, I'm sure the day in the life of Alice McDermott is so fascinating. What is your day like, a normal day?
Oh, well, it's pretty dull. I mean, I think this is why Hollywood has never been able to portray what writers do without adding something ridiculous to it. You know, I'm from a middle-class family, and I've always treated this as if it's a real job. So from the nice thing about that is it helps other people who think you're just sitting around drinking coffee or wine and staring out the window, and that's work. So I try to be at my desk at 9 o'clock in the morning. Occasionally I'll take a break for coffee or lunch and then stay there. I used to stay, while my kids were growing up, I would stay at my desk till 3 o'clock and then they came home. You have to be there. Now that they're off on their own, you know, I make 9 to 6, 9 to 7. Just being there doesn't mean that you're writing. doesn't mean that you're writing particularly well. It can be revision. It can be doing research. But, you know, just that I always think, you know, if I were a waitress, I would have to be there. If I were a surgeon, I would have to be there. And I like having the it's not leisurely, but big chunks of time so that I can rewrite. And I can also have the courage to throw out, you know, if I get to the end of the day and think, well, those 15 pages got me to one sentence that I want to save and the rest of that was just a dead end, or it was just my telling myself something that the reader doesn't need to know, but that I need to know so I can throw them out. It's easier to throw stuff out when you know tomorrow morning I'll be back, rather than if you save those writing time and I can't get back till next month, I better save these 14 pages, whether the reader should have them or not.
Now, you talked about the waitress. You talked about a surgeon. The waitress always has conflicts with customers a lot. Perhaps the surgeon with the head of the hospital. Do you have problems with some of your characters?
Oh, sure. Yeah. In all kinds of ways. Again, not to make it sound too weird, you know, it's not quite channeling, but, you know, anything that you say about a character eliminates a million other options for that character. When you describe the character physically, when you give the character a gesture. So it's not so much that characters dictate who they are. The writer is dictating it, but there is a logic to it. And it's a kind of agreement with the reader. If I tell you that this character walks down the street in this certain way, well, then you should assume, and I think as readers we do, that I need to know that. That's valuable. That detail is valuable because it will tell me something about the character later on. So for the writer, for the first reader, when, you know, you make certain statements, you give certain facts to your fictional characters, you're stuck with them. And so you really, again, the nuns, I think, were the biggest challenge. There's a young nun. She's young at the beginning of the story and old by the end of the story. And as soon as she appeared in the first chapter, I thought, this is the one with the purest and the simplest faith. And I don't understand that. I, as a 21st century, not so great Catholic, you know, always questioning, always doubting, a contrarian, drove my parents crazy even as a small child with my annoying questions about the things that they took for granted. I understood as soon as she appeared that I didn't understand her faith. And I knew who she was and I knew what she looked like. And all those things were connected to the simplicity and the power of her faith. So I realized I am going to have to really struggle to see inside her and to look out from behind her eyes because I'm not that kind of Christian.
All right, Alice, do you have a website? I want to find out more about your brand new book, In Softcover, The Ninth Hour, along with other books.
Yes, and it's simple enough. It's alice-mcdermott.com, and a little dash between the two. The first name and the last.
All right. Well, you know, I probably could have gone another hour with you. This has been fantastic. A great guest, Alice McDermott. She has that brand new book, The Ninth Hour. Check out that website. National bestseller, Alice McDermott. Now, this book, I tell you what, from the beginning, you're going to feel the pain that this person is feeling that's going to commit suicide. The pain of his young wife. And Alice brings this book so much to life, you're going to actually see it. Alice, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Been listening to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Alice McDermott, author of The Ninth Hour.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.